Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Depending on where you are August 21st, you may be able to look up at the sky during the day and see a total solar eclipse. Or you might know it's happening, but not see anything at all. So what is a total solar eclipse? And what will we be able to see from Delaware later this month? Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pike has turned to University of Delaware astronomy professor Dr. John Gieses for answers.
Dr. Gieses, what is a total solar eclipse, and how do these kinds of things happen?
Well, from our point of view on Earth, if you are in the path of a total solar eclipse, what you'll see is the moon will pass directly in front of the sun and block its light for a few minutes. And so it will become dark like night. You will be able to see some faint gas maybe that surrounds the sun called the corona, but it only lasts a couple minutes. What's really happening is that when the moon passes directly between the Earth and sun, it has a shadow. And so the shadow is falling on Earth, and of course that makes it turn dark. But it's a fairly rare event for any given location on the Earth.
So it is a fairly rare event, as you just said, and it seems like there's a lot of hype about this particular one happening in August.
Yeah, because it's been quite rare for the total solar eclipses to be seen in the mainland of the U.S. I remember when I was a kid, it happened in 1979, and so they were saying that it was going to be many years until there was another total solar eclipse in the U.S., and so now all these years later, it's finally happening. So, you know, people will be able to see it without traveling a lot. Now, if you're into eclipses, of course, it happens somewhere on Earth several times a year usually. And so if you don't mind flying somewhere, you know, possibly on a plane over an ocean someplace, then you can see an eclipse if you're determined enough. But this will be, you know, accessible to millions of Americans who will just be able to step outside and see it.
So eclipses do happen several times a year, but the odds of an eclipse happening where you live or near where you live can be pretty low.
Yeah, so it turns out that the shadow, to get everything lined up perfectly so that you get a total solar eclipse, is only about 50 to 100 miles wide. So even though it traces out a long arc that maybe is 1,000 miles wide or more, you know, you have to be just in the right place.
And what will we be able to see from Delaware?
Now, many more people will see a partial solar eclipse. So here in Delaware, you know, the moon will cover 80% of the sun, which is a lot, but it's not going to make the really dramatic thing where, you know, day turns to night and getting the real total solar eclipse. You might not even notice anything was going on unless you observe the sun. And everyone always wants us to remind the public that you should never look at the sun directly during a partial solar eclipse or not an eclipse at all, unless you have, you know, very special glasses, not regular sunglasses, but what are called eclipse glasses that are very thick. They're kind of like welder's glasses, and they let hardly any light through, because otherwise it's very dangerous, and you can burn out your retina. So that'll be the main effect. The other thing that you can do is you can make a pinhole camera, and so if you make a hole in a piece of paper or something, the image of the sun will pass through the pinhole, and you'll be able to see that the moon is blocking part of it. And you can get instructions of how to make one online.
I might need to look into that. I'm also already looking into getting some glasses.
Yeah, you want to order them now, because they may be running short. But of course, because of the eclipse, and you know, we've known it's coming, a lot of them have been made, and a lot of companies have been distributing them.
And so even though this kind of eclipse is particularly rare, we've seen a few different kinds of eclipses over the last few decades or so. Do you personally have any stories about going to see an eclipse?
Well, I went to the 1991 total solar eclipse, partly because I was working in New Mexico at the National Solar Observatory. And at that time, the eclipse path first passed over Hawaii that year and then went into Mexico itself. So four of us jumped in a car, 20-year-olds not knowing what we're doing, and drove all the way through Mexico to the path of the eclipse, where we found a beach where everyone was set up to watch the eclipse, and people shared their telescopes, and it was a wonderful experience. It was certainly one of the most memorable things I've done in my life.
Yeah, and what was that like for you seeing that?
Oh, I was amazed how dramatic it really is. You know, I'd seen partial eclipses, and I've seen lunar eclipses where, you know, where the moon turns dark because it's in the Earth's shadow. And those are not as exciting as a total solar eclipse. And the total eclipse, it really became dark. It was really as if night suddenly came. it cooled off very rapidly. I mean, you realized how much we depend on the sun for warmth, you know, during the daytime. And, you know, you could even feel the wind rising because of the temperature differences all of a sudden. It was really very dramatic. And, of course, you know, through the telescope, which was, you know, properly equipped, of course, you know, you could see all these things that you can see in pictures, which is, you know, that there's this sort of bright gas surrounding the sun called the corona.
I am curious if there's any sort of, like, rising seas and climate change here on our Earth. Would that eventually affect our ability to see an eclipse?
I don't think the climate change would affect that. However, the moon is gradually getting further away from the sun. So over the course of thousands of years, the eclipses gradually get shorter. And so someday in the very, very distant future, there won't be total solar eclipses anymore because the moon will be further away and it will look smaller. It won't be big enough to block the sun. But none of us will. None of us have to worry about that.
And so eclipses gradually get shorter. How short is this one, and how does that compare to past eclipses?
This one, the total solar eclipse, depending on where you are, is sort of 1 or 2 minutes. And exactly how long they are depend on, you know, the details of the geometry and how fast the moon is going relative to the sun at that particular moment. And so the one I saw in Mexico was 7 minutes, which was, you know, sort of the longest of the century. I remember they were hyping it up as. But if you saw it in Hawaii, it was actually only 4 minutes long. And so whether it's 2 minutes long or 1 minute long depends on where you are in the U.S. for this particular eclipse. The partial eclipse lasts a long time. It takes a couple hours if you want to see, you know, just a little bit of the sun being blocked by the moon, like a little arc, then you're not quite so time sensitive.
But if you blink, you really could miss it, right?
Well, it's more than a blink, but yeah, absolutely. You know, a cloud might come at just the wrong moment, right? And then it will still turn dark, and things will happen. But, you know, I think that would be, you know, a little disappointing, you know, depending on how far you traveled.
That's true. And it really is weather dependent, right?
Well, absolutely. It's the same, you know, as seeing the sun, right? So if it's a foggy day and, you know, covered in rain, then, you know, it's not going to be that dramatic. You know, it'll still get dark and the moon will still block the sun, but it won't be quite the same experience, I don't think.
Gotcha. So on NASA's eclipse website, they say the last total solar eclipse viewed from a contiguous United States was on February 26th, 1979. And then after the August 2017 total solar eclipse, the next one in the United States will be October 14th, 2023, seen from Northern California to Florida. Then we'll have another one, April 8th, 2024, Texas to Maine. I think one of those might be a partial eclipse here, but I'm wondering if you have anything to say about, you know, the frequency of what we'll see, you know, after this year.
Yeah, the April 2024 is a very promising one, as you said, right? It starts in Mexico and comes up through Texas and through Maine. I talked with one of the other people at the University of Delaware, and it goes over his mother's house in Indiana. So this eclipse is sort of 50 miles away from his mother's house, and the next eclipse goes right over it. So they're very lucky. Overall, you know, the eclipses do have a kind of pattern to them, and every 18 years the cycle kind of repeats but move to a different part of the Earth due to the way that things time. So there can be, you know, periods of time where we get very few eclipses and then periods where we get more, but over time it all averages out. I read that NASA calculated that if you wanted to have the entire U.S., you know, experience an eclipse, then basically over 1,000 years every point sees an eclipse at, you know, at some point, right? But of course never all at once.
And what will you be doing on the day of the total solar eclipse?
Well, I'm going to be hoping for good weather, and I'm going to make a pinhole camera too, and then we'll see how it works out.
Thanks to UD astronomy professor Dr. John Gieses and R. Katie Pikus for their time this week. We turn now to our History Matters segment and historic preservation. A number of historic buildings, from the Thomas England House to Somerton Mansion in Middletown, have been demolished in recent months. Historic preservation advocates are rallying to change that, and Nonprofit Preservation Delaware is willing to help organize such efforts in the first state. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly sat down with the group's executive director, James Hamby.
So tell me about your vision for the organization. Well, I'd like to see Preservation Delaware become what its organizing really was supposed to be about, which is a statewide organization for historic preservation. It used to be. It kind of fell back off of that, and so we're working on rebuilding and hopefully through meetings like this, bringing folks out that are interested in historic preservation and are concerned about the loss of our historic fabric, we can get back up to speed and be that statewide organization for historic preservation, education, and advocacy across the state.
When do you think it really kind of fell out of its mission a little bit?
Yeah, probably... it started when, and I'm not sure of exactly what year it occurred, but they acquired the Gibraltar property up in Wilmington and the gardens attached. And there's a lot of time, effort, and money involved in owning a property. And that really took away from its statewide mission because it then became all about Gibraltar. And so we no longer own the mansion. We still own the gardens, which do require a bit of upkeep, but there is a committee that deals with that. And so we're hoping that with a rebuilt board of directors, we can reach out to across the state and hold workshops, you know, speak with our elected officials and just be a force for historic preservation that's missing a voice.
Within kind of the education piece and the advocacy arena, what are some specific things that you hope to work on?
Just making people aware of the resources that are available to them. For businesses, making them aware of the tax credits that are available for historic preservation, both from the state and the federal level. For private property owners, just making them aware of, you know, there are grants and things that are available to help them over the hump if they're looking at a project that they think is maybe a little too big for them. And also just folks that can help them in understanding how to do the projects that they are. One of the things Preservation Delaware did in the past was they held in each of the counties workshops on how to care for historic windows, things like that. Windows can be one of the biggest expenses if you own a historic property because of the heat loss and also in the summertime keeping air conditioning in. And so being able to help people figure out how they can inexpensively preserve their historic windows. They don't have to go tear all the historic windows out and put in new windows, which really destroys the fabric of the building. It was an important thing that they did, but we haven't done it in years. The case of the house that was down in the Middletown area that was on the Historic Review Board agenda, the folks were really there for demolition permit because they didn't know what else to do. And that's sad. We should be there to be able to explain to them, maybe you want to do this, maybe you want to do that, and help them through that process. And ultimately, they may have ended up at the board for a demolition permit, but they would have tried a bunch of other stuff first.
And in terms of advocacy, you had written some, is it county code, to try and get Newcastle County to change their ways a little bit in terms of how they review properties for demolition?
Sure. I had used some language out of a Connecticut historic preservation ordinance, which just ensured that the public had adequate input in the process before a historic home was approved for demolition. It's lacking sometimes now in Newcastle County. It's even more lacking elsewhere in the state. As the Thomas England House taught us, there really wasn't any public meeting or anything for anybody to weigh in on. And so my code amendment for Newcastle County would have required that they post the demolition permits on their website for a period of time and would have allowed any member of the public or any member of the Historic Review Board to say they thought it was historic. And if they did, then it would at least get a hearing at the Historic Review Board. Right now, the County Historic Preservation Planner goes out, looks at it. If he or she thinks it doesn't meet any of the criteria, they can sign off on it, and the demolition permit never goes to the Historic Review Board, never gets a public hearing, and then people find out about it, and maybe they bring to light information the Historic Preservation Planner didn't know. And so we feel when you're dealing with historic properties, they should at least get a public hearing. And that's all we're really looking for, is the ability for the public to speak and weigh in on really their county.
Historically, has the organization kind of met with developers and kind of helped them through the process of potentially restoring a building?
Not that I'm aware of, but I think it's something that is missing because, at least, like I say, in Newcastle County, there is a density bonus for historic preservation that, if it ever was used, I'm not aware of it. And so we need to ask why. And who can we ask why that would know better than the developers that don't use it? So why not sit down with them and say, what do you think would make it more likely that you would preserve a historic property? Are there other incentives that would work better? And maybe there's not. Maybe there's not any dealing with them, but I think that there is. I think there's some middle ground. As someone else says, if it's in their financial interest, they'll do it. And so we just need to figure out what that trigger is.
How many, do you know how many homes or how many historic properties have been demolished last several months?
It depends on who you ask. At least four or five that we've lost probably in the last 4 to 6 months in between Kent and Newcastle County that we're aware of. It certainly is part of what we hope will be the outgrowth of this group is having folks throughout the state that are communicating so we know if these things are threatened or we know if it's occurred in other places, because right now something could happen in Western Sussex County and we may not even know about it. So, it's really important that all of us that are interested throughout the state are communicating and forming that network to really be advocates across the whole state, not just in certain areas that are strong in historic preservation.
Sounds like you're going to be the umbrella organization, perhaps.
We hope. We hope. We hope that folks will decide that Preservation Delaware is the vehicle to move that forward throughout the state. That's what its mission was, and we hope that that's what folks will decide can be, again, the mission.
Thanks to our Megan Pauly and Preservation Delaware's James Hanby for their time. And The Green continues momentarily with our second roundtable discussion with a handful of young African leaders at UD this summer as part of a nationwide fellowship program. Stick around. You're listening to Delaware Public Media.